TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Professor Michael Hudson on the Rentier Economy, Polarization, Then a Crash. In December 2020, Lynn Fries, founder and producer of GPE News Docs, interviewed the economist Michael Hudson. Lynn's focus is on the global political economy. Her research and video journalism as not-for-profit public service began in New York City in 2007. Among contemporary economists, Michael Hudson uses and refines terms that explain the specific brand of today's finance capitalism. That includes the acronym FIRE and the term Rentier Economy. The FIRE sector, says Hudson, stands for finance, insurance, and real estate. Hudson uses the term to make clear that we are experiencing a huge power shift from industrial to finance capitalism. Lynn Fries wrote in a brief introduction on her website that she wanted to explore with Michael Hudson how, quote, allied with landlords and monopolists, this powerful finance sector is extracting economic rents from the economy that's impoverishing U.S. government as well as industry and labor, and how the chokehold of pro-finance, pro-rentier capitalism is reaching into the present COVID-19 crisis, end quote. Here are excerpts from the 40-minute interview, Lynn Fries.
I'm delighted to have Michael Hudson joining us today. He'll be discussing how under a neoliberal shift from industrial to finance capitalism, today's most pressing economic conflict is not simply between labor and employers. It's a conflict in which rentier interests have the upper hand over labor, industry, and government together. This is the political economy in which the COVID-19 economic shock is playing out with dire consequences. Michael Hudson is a research professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and a research associate at the Levy Economics Institute of Bard College. A prolific author, Michael Hudson's latest book is And Forgive Them Their Debts, Lending, Foreclosure, and Redemption, From Bronze Age Finance to the Jubilee Year. Welcome, Michael.
Good to be here, Lynn.
Michael, it's been argued that every successful economy has been a mixed economy, where the public sector places checks and balances on private sector power, specifically on the financial sector's power to indebt society in ways that impoverish it. Yet this kind of role for the public sector is being vilified under finance capitalism. So what's your take on that?
The financial sector essentially is the 1% or the 10% that holds the rest of the economy in debt. The financial sector makes its money by getting the rest of the economy in debt to itself and making money off asset price gains. In the past, the financial sector made its money by getting interest. But now, with almost zero interest, what it's after for is capital gains, because capital gains basically are either untaxed or taxed at a very, very low rate. So the financial sector essentially makes its money not by being part of the production and consumption economy, but by siphoning off as much money from the production and consumption economy as it can for real estate, for insurance, and for debt service and banking services. The insurance, of course, would include the health insurance. The result is that Americans have to spend so much of their money now on housing. Up to 43% of their income goes for housing, as opposed to 25% back in the 1940s and 50s and 60s. They have to pay huge amounts for medical insurance. And the taxes have been shifted off real estate, off finance, onto labor and industry. So you have America really being unable to revive its industry today, because how can you create an export industry or even compete with foreigners when you have to pay such high housing costs, such high medical insurance and healthcare costs instead of the government taking over, such high debt service. If you got all of your clothing and food and basic needs for nothing, you still couldn't compete with foreigners because of all of these fire sector, finance, insurance, and real estate costs. Now, the job of the government under industrial capitalism was all spelled out in the late 19th century in the United States. For instance, by Simon Patton, who was the first professor of economics at the first business school, the Wharton School, at the University of Pennsylvania. And Patton said that public infrastructure was a fourth factor of production, and the role of the government was to provide basic needs like health care, education, transportation, other basic services at very low price so that you lower the cost of doing business, you lower the cost of living so that the private sector will be able to compete with foreign countries. Now, most countries now provide free health care, because if they didn't, then the employers and the labor would have to pay health care. Their cost of production would be much higher. And America's not done that. America has the highest cost of production in the world, not because it's technologically inefficient. The technology is all available and there. The reason is all of these extra costs that are paid by labor and by employers that are borne by governments in other countries. So as long as essentially America's dismantling the government, what you're dismantling is the basic means of subsidizing industrial production and manufacturing. And that's what's left America in a high-cost position and driven American industry abroad without any idea of how to create a national economy that makes it profitable to invest in industry here. So most of the American cost structure has nothing to do with the cost of production, and therefore nothing to do with industry or industrial capitalism. It's a fallback into a kind of post-medieval rentier economy.
Michael, in the rentier economy, banks have allied with landlords and monopolists. So comment more on banks and monopolies.
Banks have always been called the mother of trusts. Back in the 19th century, you had the great fortunes on Wall Street being made by creating the steel trust, the copper trust. The function of banks is to lend money to companies to essentially create monopolies in the market that can control the prices and extract super profits, namely economic rent over and above the actual cost of production and normal profits. And when you have a trust, a monopoly, you can get monopoly rent over and above the normal rate of profit. And the bank said, well, look, we can work with companies to let a few companies like Carnegie take over the steel industry. You've had agriculture, agribusiness in this country really turn into a trust with two firms monopolizing all of the distribution of agricultural products. You've had essentially Amazon becoming a monopoly. You have the information technology sector turning into a monopoly. And the function of these monopolies is the reason their stock prices are going up so much is because they're setting the price without any anti-monopoly legislation, such as you had under the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890, and then Teddy Roosevelt is a trust buster. You, essentially, since the 1980s, you've not had any anti-monopoly prosecutions at all. So the economy has been more and more concentrated in the hands of a few large companies that have been able to get the credit from the banks to buy potential rivals, such as Facebook has been buying its rivals. You have the cable companies as rivals, so people's cable rates continue to go up and up without any actual cost increase. You have a dissociation of price from the cost of production. Price is whatever the market will bear. There is no longer the reference to the cost of production, and hence profits is understood under industrial capitalism as a rate of return on the the cost of production and the capital investment. You have essentially prices being dictated by a financially organized trustification and monopolization of the economy, most conspicuously in the United States, of course.
We should also note pharmaceutical monopolies.
That's the most obvious. And when you have prices of drugs here so much higher than you have in Canada and other countries, the President George W. Bush said, we're not going to bargain with the firms. We're not going to have to do what every other country does, where the government gets to buy in bulk. The whole idea is if you buy in bulk, you get a low price. And George Bush says, we're going to pay the retail price and then a little bit more, because after all, they're his campaign contributors. Under the Obamacare, you had a huge giveaway written by the pharmaceutical industry. And the people that Biden have appointed as the health czars were the lobbyists and the heads of the pharmaceutical companies. So you're going to have a very vicious pharmaceutical monopoly squeezing the population here. Already in Idaho, where there's a very heavy COVID issue, people are now being put in jail for medical deaths. If you can't pay the hospital, you can be arrested, put in jail, and then you die as everybody in jail gets COVID. It's like a financial Death Star has hit America. And the Death Star isn't COVID itself. COVID's all over the world. Other countries have been able to cope. It's the financial Death Star that's really killing people in the United States.
So, Michael, how is it that industrial capitalism ended up in the stage you described, one of a pro-rentier, pro-finance capitalism?
Well, nobody really expected industrial capitalism to enter the stage we're in now, which is finance capitalism. This was not a necessary stage of industrial capitalism, because you think of a stage as a kind of natural evolution, Darwinian style, where the most efficient stage or form wins out. But what's happened is, instead of evolution, you have a devolution. You have a move backwards. The whole idea of industrial capitalism, as explained from Adam Smith to David Ricardo to John Stuart Mill to Marx, the whole idea was that the destiny of industrial capitalism was to get rid of the remnants of feudalism, to get rid of the landlord class, of economic rent, of natural resource rent. And the idea was to make everybody basically only earn money in proportion to what they contributed to production. Industrial capitalism was supposed to clear away the whole overgrowth of absentee landlordism, of unproductive credit or usury capital. And that seemed to be happening by the late 19th century. In the field of finance, for instance, you had German and Central European industrial banking creating credit only to create new means of production, to build factories, to create a steel industry. World War I changed all that. Since World War I, the rentier class has begun to fight back. Before World War I, you finally had the United States pass an income tax law that really only 1% of the American population was liable for the income tax law, because there was a cutoff point. You had to be fairly rich to pay the income, and most of the income of wealthy people was from either rents or stocks or bonds, financially, or from loans. And after World War I, all of this was changed. Instead of taxing real estate, instead of taxing the oil and gas industry, they were made pretty much income tax exempt. You had a shift of tax onto labor and industry, and you had industrial capitalism lose out to finance capitalism, not as a step forward, but as a lapse backward, as the old post-feudal landlord class and the financial class fought back and sort of took over the development. And that was greatly increased in the 1980s with Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher. And since then, the whole Western world has been characterized by really a kind of neoliberal, meaning pro-financial, pro-rentier economy. And the result is that we have a financial view of the world, not an industrial view of the world.
Earlier in the conversation, you explained the financial sector essentially makes its money not by being part of the production and consumption economy, but by siphoning off as much money as it can from the production and consumption economy. So how is this unprecedented income and wealth that rentier interests have extracted from the real economy being redeployed?
The 1% makes most of its money by lending money to the 99% and making the 99% pay debt service to itself. The 1% own most of the bonds of banks, meaning ownership of the banks, and they essentially use their income to buy more and more assets. They don't use their income to buy new factories or to make new means of production. They may buy out a company, and then they'll downsize the labor force, they'll wipe out pension obligations, they'll dismantle the factory and turn it into gentrified housing. So instead of the progressive taxation that you have under, say, President Eisenhower in the 1950s, you have essentially regressive taxation. You've slashed the taxes on the upper incomes very low, and you've made most of the upper income money tax exempt. If you're making money by financial speculation, you only have to pay 15% of your gains, not the full income tax that used to be 90% of the gains. So essentially, you've shifted the taxes off speculators, off the 1% that makes its money by capital gains and stocks and bonds and rising real estate prices. And you've burdened employers and employees with it. And that's the legacy of debt deflation that's leading to an accelerating shrinkage today without either political party making any discussion of how this is occurring, and without the economics curriculum even discussing debt. Almost all the economic theories that have been sponsored by the business schools, the University of Chicago, Harvard, they treat the economy as if it all operates on barter. They're only looking at current costs. They're not looking at the balance sheet of the economy. They're not looking at the financial claims, the stocks, bonds, and loans, the whole superstructure of financial wealth that is extracting money from the economy, the whole way in which the gross national product and national income accounts are created, are not breaking out the distinction between making money by industrial capitalism or making money by finance capitalism. And so people are not even aware of why they're being more and more squeezed, why they're getting poor. The result is suicide rates are going up, lifespans are shortening for the lower incomes, because people are blaming themselves. The whole doctrine of personal responsibility means it's not the system that's making you poor, it's not finance, it's your responsibility to survive. That's what happened in Russia after the neoliberals did their reforms in the 1990s. It's what happened in Greece after the Eurozone insisted on Greece paying the IMF and the Eurozone for fraudulent debts that were run up by its financial class. It's something that's happening all over the world, and yet this doesn't appear as an object lesson for countries to look at and say, do things really have to be this way? Is there really no alternative? And if you think there's no alternative, you're not going to look at all the alternatives you have. There's very little discussion of what China's doing. I mean, how did China pull ahead? It pulled ahead by very heavy government spending on building up buildings, on subsidizing real estate, in paying for most of the costs of living and doing business that are privatized in the United States and have to be paid by employers. So there's a reason why China has become the largest economy in the world, overtaking the U.S., and there's no discussion of that. That's called, well, that's communism. We don't want that. And what it is, it's industrial capitalism. So industrial capitalism is now called communism. I mean, that's the irony of the whole thing, because that was where industrial capitalism was evolving towards, is an attempt to minimize the cost of production and create an efficient economy.
You published a book as a dictionary or guide to reality in an age of deception, titled J is for Junk Economics. And in the book, you define that there is no alternative, or TINA, as the neoliberal principle that if one can censor awareness of policy alternatives to austerity, people will believe that poverty, inequality, and economic polarization are natural, not man-made. What else do pro-finance advocates mean in saying there is no alternative?
Well, when Margaret Thatcher said there is no alternative, and that was her famous quote, TINA, there is no alternative, what she meant is the financial sector has put debt charges into the economy saying there's no alternative if you want to avoid a breakdown. And the breakdown is right now the economy is in a debt deflation. So much American industry is closing down because of debt. For instance, let's look at the legacy of the coronavirus, which has only catalyzed and accelerated the debt deflation. Imagine the restaurants that are closed since last March, the gyms, the bars, they haven't done business, so they have not been paying rent, and their employees have not been getting an income to pay their rent. So what's happened is that, let's say, in January, everything is going to go back to normal, although they say here it's going to be March or April. Well, the landlords are going to say, okay, we haven't been collecting rent for the last year. Now you're going to have to pay all this, these rent arrears. Well, there is no way that a restaurant or a gym or a bar can pay a year's back rent and make enough profit to cover it. So they're going to say, why should we work for the landlord without getting any pennies for ourselves? We're just going to go out of business. And so the restaurants are closed down. This, again, is a reason for the stock market booming. If you close down the privately owned restaurants and the privately owned bars, this is going to let the big food chains come in and take over the whole market, just like Amazon took over much of the market for books and for things that people buy. The big restaurant chains will come in now that maybe 70% of the restaurants in New York City are expected to go out of business. So the only way to avoid all of this is to say, okay, we, the government, are suspending all of the debt service, all the taxes, and all the rents owed during the period when nobody can earn an income to pay. If you don't wipe out the arrears of the debt that have accumulated for the back rent, people running into debt in order to live while they're unemployed, running up their credit card rates, borrowing from the banks, or borrowing against the house, if you don't wipe out this debt, then you're going to have the economy shut down with debt deflation because there won't be any money to buy goods and services, and it'll be just an accelerating unemployment and a shrinkage of markets. Now, when Margaret Thatcher said there's no alternative, what she meant was, well, wait a minute, if you don't pay the debts to the banks, they'll have to lose money. The richest 1% have made $1 trillion in gains since the virus hit last spring. They've made a killing. In the last 10 years, all of the growth in the American economy has accrued the top 5%. All the growth in GDP, gross domestic product, has accrued to the top 5%. Since Obama took office, GDP for the 95% of the population has actually gone down. And the banks are saying, well, wait a minute, we've made a lot of money. We don't want to have to lose any of it. If you write down the debts, we're just going to close up shop and we'll pull out all of the connections of the economy and the banks will go under. They pretend that this is a crisis. Actually, this is a great opportunity to save the economy. Sheila Bair said in 2009 that the most badly run bank and crooked bank was Citibank. She wanted to close it down and take it over by the FDIC. There was plenty of money in Citibank to pay all of the insured depositors, but then she was overruled by Obama and Tim Geithner, the lobbyist for Wall Street, who was connected to Citibank in a shameful conflict of interest. And they didn't close it down. And Sheila Bair wrote in her biography about this, it, she found out it was all about the bondholders. The 1% are the bondholders of the bank. They would rather have the economy shut down and 10 million more people thrown into the street than lose a single dollar. Now, the good thing about canceling the debts is that you cancel savings on the other side of the balance sheet. And the savings are all this immense amount of money that's accumulated by the rentier sector since Obama took office, really, since the 2008 and 9 crisis. And you'd restore balance to the economy. You would restore a much more equal distribution, not only of income, but of wealth, by having the wealthy people bear the costs of the economy being shut down for the virus. The rentier sector opposes all of this. And in fact, Biden has already said that because of the huge $8 trillion giveaway to the financial sector by the Federal Reserve under Trump, we're going to have to balance the budget. The cities and states are near bankruptcy. In New York City, they're talking about cutting down the subway system to maybe only 40%. It'll be very crowded. You'll be risking your life to go on it because of the virus. The Washington subway system has been closed down on weekends, and I think many stations have been closed down. You're going to have a breakdown of state and local finance because the landlords are not able to pay the property tax. The cities and states are not getting the income tax because of the unemployment. You're going to have a spreading financial crisis. And again, finance capital firms are going to be able to come in, and it's much easier to make $1 billion off a crisis than it is off a boom. Most of the big fortunes have all been made when the rest of the economy are in crisis because everybody's in distress. You can buy assets in distress prices. And that's why the crisis that's coming to the United States is almost engineered by Wall Street is a grab bag. And it'll be a grab bag with they're expecting 50,000 New Yorkers to be homeless. They're going to be out on the street. You're having a disaster, and it's a disaster that is welcomed by the government, that is refusing to do any bailout for the cities and states, refusing any support of the infrastructure system, the transport system, that is only providing money to support the stock and bondholders so that they don't lose money, and to support the banks so that they remain solvent with a quantitative easing money creation, but without any attempt to revive the industrial economy, the restaurant owners, the few factories that remain, and of course the labor force.
That was Michael Hudson, research professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and research associate at Bard College. Michael Hudson's latest book is And Forgive Them Their Debts, Lending, Foreclosure, and Redemption, From Bronze Age Finance to the Jubilee Year. You heard excerpts from a 40-minute interview by Len Fries, founder and producer of GPE News Docs. They spoke on December 23, 2020. Len Fries' research and video journalism began in New York City in 2007. For the full interview and a transcript, go to gpenewsdocs.com or to the website of theanalysis.news. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.